If somebody's like really contracted and their nervous system's really dysregulated, they were to open fully to redemptive love completely, it might actually be too overwhelming. Sometimes it has to be taken in bit by bit.
Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump. My name is Rick Archer. Buddha at the Gas Pump is an ongoing series of interviews with, or conversations rather, with spiritually awakening people. And we've done over 700 of them now. So if this is new to you and you'd like to check out previous ones, you know, you can just poke around on the YouTube channel itself. But if you go to batgap.com, you'll find that everything organized in various ways that are much easier to search than on batgap.com. Please consider subscribing to the channel. It helps in terms of YouTube's algorithm and all that to bring the show to more people. This whole thing is made possible through the support of appreciative listeners and viewers. So if you appreciate it and would like to help support it financially, there are PayPal buttons on every page of the website. And there are also some volunteer opportunities, so you can get in touch with us about that. They mainly involve proofreading transcripts, but there's some other things too. We have a volunteers page where you'll see some of the people who are volunteering and what they're doing. So my guest today is Savita Virna. Is that the way you pronounce it?
Vera.
Vera. Savita Vera, sorry. She is in Western Australia, so it's like 8 in the morning for her, 7 in the evening for me. She's a spiritual teacher, a mentor, an embodiment facilitator, and a healer. We'll be getting into all this in detail, but she experienced a profound shift in consciousness after great tragedy, followed by years of further spiritual openings, mystical experiences, and deep healing. And she meets people as a teacher with generosity, humor, and grounded practicality, providing a safe space for them to open to their own divine light and inner wisdom. Okay, so you didn't write a book, so I didn't read a book like I often do, but I listened to everything you had on your YouTube channel. I did an interesting thing. I transcribed everything you have that I could find, that in other interviews you've done and talks you gave, and I fed it all into AI along with the notes you gave me. And I said, give me talking points and questions for an interview on this content. And bingo, within a minute, I had 4 pages of notes printed out with questions.
You plugged me into the matrix.
I did. So I've been doing that lately. It's kind of handy. So, you know, I'm coming up with some questions I wouldn't ordinarily have thought to ask. Plus, I throw in a bunch of my own questions that the AI didn't give me. So it's not just an AI thing. What I've gathered is that one of the main themes of your journey is awakening through adversity. And it began with a childhood trauma and was catalyzed by the sudden loss of a mentor, leading you from a place of unconscious seeking to becoming a trauma-specialized spiritual guide. And of course, there are a lot of steps in between those two things. And this path seems to be the foundation of what you call authentic empowerment. Is that a fair synopsis?
Yeah.
Good. You mentioned some tragedy very early in life that kind of kick-started your seeking?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had a difficult childhood, so there was that sort of background of that.
Welcome
and,
to
you
the
know,
club.
In hindsight, yeah, that's right. Most of us do. There's a few lucky ones. That, you know, you look back in hindsight and you can see that seeking, trying to get away from suffering, but not even necessarily being so conscious of the suffering. You can be sort of numbed out to it.
Right.
Because that's, you know, part of that coping strategy of
shut down.
Not even realizing, how much is actually there. But little breadcrumbs, little snippets, you know, that come along that just like, oh, go this way, go this way. And that sort of happened through my 20s. You know, I'd be directed to books and I didn't have any religious upbringing. I didn't have spiritual community or any sort of deep connection with spirituality, but there was something in me that just buy a Buddhist book or buy a book on healing, little bits of your
impulses.
Little impulses. I remember going to you know, I only went a couple of times in my 20s to Buddhist meditation, and I thought there's something here. I don't know what it is, but there's something here. And I think it was like a counting meditation or something.
Counting your breaths?
Yeah, it was something like that. And there was one lady in the group afterwards that said that she got to 10, like it was totally easy. You know, it just happened. And something in me knew that it wasn't true. And I knew that, I don't know what you even call it, the nun running the meditation, I knew that she knew as well. But I didn't know what that was. I didn't know what it was, the underlying thing. But it's like that radar for truth, you know.
So in other words, the woman was being inauthentic and you picked up on it.
Yeah. Well, you know, just innocent.
I see. Innocent. And people might be wondering, like, the big deal, I can count to 10. But I think what you're referring to is, you know, a meditation where you're supposed to, like, count the breaths without your mind wandering off. And, you know, if you try that sometime, you might find that you might be surprised at how readily your mind wanders off when trying to do a simple thing like that.
Yeah. And how it gets caught. Yeah. Caught in thought. So that were kind of my early years mixed with lots of different, just lots of different experience. Yeah. Really saw lots of the extremes, you know, in life from the poorest and some of the most traumatized sectors of society to some of the wealthiest, you know, just by chance, not because I've got any connection to that in particular, but, and all the suffering, you know, that comes with that. Fast forward.
Before we fast forward too much, I had a long conversation with a friend the other day, whom I have long conversations with often, and we were contemplating how a very traumatic childhood can result in rather ardent spiritual seeking later, a little bit later on. On the other hand, you know, like the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, says that if you're really fortunate, you'll be born in a pure and illustrious family, or even a family of yogis, although that's more difficult to attain on earth. So you've got it easy. The Buddha, in fact, was born a king and grew up in a palace. And yet when he realized how much suffering there was in the world, he left all that and became an extremely ardent seeker. I mean, just enlightenment or bust. So we were just contemplating, like, which one is most advantageous? Not that we get to choose. And are we just burning off a load of karma if we have a very traumatic childhood? And then after that's burned off, we're free to soar high on our spiritual quest? Or is there some advantage to suffering because the desire to get out of it becomes so strong that you just don't take your spiritual practice for granted? You just go at it with all your might or whatever. What are your thoughts on that?
The pressure cooker. I don't think that we can ever take one person's awakening or unfolding or whatever you want to call it and then kind of make a
generalization.
Yeah, not even the Buddha's, as much as we love him. You know, because it's probably far more nuanced and complex.
Yeah, you're probably right. You can't
than our human mind can
make. You can't generalize too much.
No, because for me, it wasn't ardent spiritual seeking. It just happened. So, you know, spontaneous. So you could say, well, it was the pressure, the contraction. The contractions were so great that then the expansion happened. And that seems to have been my thing. You know, I get put in these koans where I'm backs against the wall, or seemingly so, and then, you know, that lets go into a bigger awareness. Yeah, I think because our minds like to have it all wrapped up, you know, our minds like to say, well, what is this? It was so curious, and that's beautiful. It just is, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you make a good point, which is that there are as many paths as there are people, and it is a little foolish to generalize, although you do sometimes see patterns. We'll get into that more as we go along. You don't need to go into specifics if you don't want to. How do you feel your personal experiences with trauma and tragedy led to your first profound spiritual openings?
Well, the first opening was a glimpse, and the first one was that death of the mentor.
Yeah, you had a mentor who got in a car accident.
Yeah, a mentor with horsemanship, not a spiritual mentor. I wasn't doing any seeking spiritually or otherwise. And the shock of that, the suddenness of it, and his girlfriend at the time died as well in the same accident. They were both passengers in the car. And, you know, he left behind children from previous marriage, and it was a pretty rough time. And so that period of grieving and shock and all of that, that's what led to that first really simple opening in a really simple moment of hanging out clothes on the line. All that contraction, all that grief, all that just even of me just fell away. And it was just this intimacy, this beautiful, simple, peaceful intimacy. And that was like the first crack, the first opening. And then later on, that would be, I don't know. There's no sort of sense of how long I was there for. Uh-huh. It could have been.
I mean, it wasn't like weeks and weeks and weeks of peace, but it was.
No. Yeah.
I guess you were, Susanna Marie was one of your mentors, wasn't she? Or.
Yeah.
And she had something similar where her brother died unexpectedly, and it really shifted her into profound realization, as traumatic as that was. And obviously that's not the kind of impetus most of us would want to undergo to have a profound realization. But what do you think it is about a shock like that that can catalyze an opening?
I think it's probably a few things. The mind can kind of give up. Because, you know, it can't make sense of it, and it can't fix it. It can't, there's nothing it can do. So like death like that is like a koan in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's no controlling. There's nothing but surrender. I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is like fully allowing ourselves to feel, you know, and I've had that experience many times later. When I fully went into the grief, then the peace and the joy and the bliss would open.
There's a couple of
right
things in there.
The center of it.
No, finish your thought. I thought you were stopping.
Just how it's, and it's so bizarre, you know, because in the past you grieve or you have grief and it's just, it's all awful. You know, who would have thought that right at the center, if you fully let go into it, that there it is.
Yeah, interesting. There's a couple of things in there that kind of jump out at me. One is there's this whole little section near the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita where Arjuna, the hero of the story, feels like, I've got this, you know, I'm in control, I can do this, let me at these guys. And then he undergoes this shift where he all of a sudden realizes he doesn't have it and he's not in control. And, you know, and at that point, he surrenders to his master, to the Lord, you know. Krishna was supposed to be an avatar.
Yeah.
And you know, the commentary I read was like, you know, in life for all of us, as long as you think that you can do it, you're in charge, you're the controller, you know, you don't tend to surrender or look for some higher guidance or higher wisdom. But kind of if you reach that point at which you know you're not in charge, then you kind of fall on your knees, so to speak, and seek higher guidance.
Yeah, absolutely. And that can be a really nuanced space for, you know, embodiment and trauma, because often in a kind of native way, people with childhood trauma or any sort of abuse or boundary violations, there's that loss of volition, you know, that and all that comes with that. So there's some real nuance in healing that to a place where the understanding is that the infinite is safe.
You know,
and that really is can take some time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. And in a few minutes, we're going to get into talking about shadow work and healing and things. I wanted to just ask you a couple of quick questions before that. because you mentioned a minute ago going into grief and then finding peace after going through it. So we want to talk about that. But I just want to ask you the idea of authentic realization and authentic empowerment seem to be central to your work. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I got that impression. Do you have the impression that there's a lot of inauthentic realization and empowerment going on? Is that why you emphasize authenticity?
I think that there is probably a lot more that needs to clear that people realize in that way. You know, I think that that it's really easy for stuff to still be stored there in that sort of power center, and for that to grab on, even with the openings that have happened. You know, even though there might be a lot of clarity, there might have been lots of openings, there might be, you know, some embodiment, that can kind of really sort of grab onto it and create another sort of identity. And
I think that's really important, actually. There are so many examples of very impressive teachers who seem to have had profound awakenings, and yet then their behavior becomes very inappropriate and harmful to people. And you kind of realize, or I don't know, my sense of it is that there is a lot of buried stuff that they never had to confront. And it's kind of coming back to bite them, you know? And in some cases, the behavior becomes much more exaggerated in its inappropriateness than even that of a normal person.
Because that whole outsourcing, you know, if students outsource their light to, well, it's the guru up there, and that whole hierarchy thing,
it empowers them.
Then it, you know, yeah, and you know, and people can get drunk on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
people can get really intoxicated with it.
Goes to their heads.
But it's so much more. Sorry, go on.
That saying of it goes to their heads, you know, all the adulation. It's like, ooh, I must be special. Everybody loves me.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so much more. It's more quiet than that. The authentic power when it comes through, and it's really all our contractions and, you know, stuff that gets in the way of it moving. It just knows which way to move.
Yeah.
And it could be in, it could be in a boundary setting, you know, it could, and when it comes through, it happens so fast that the mind has to catch up with it. It's not a, something that comes from thinking our way through it.
Explain that a little bit. I'm not sure exactly what you mean there.
If for instance, you know, there was a situation where there needed to be like, this is this incarnation here and that's that one over there, you know, the distinction, it just will move. You know, what needs to be said, it's what needs to come through, just comes through, rather than having to think about it, you know, an intellectual exercise of, oh, I need to do this, or I need to navigate it, because that's the separateness, navigating it, rather than it just like moving.
I see. So you're speaking of spontaneous right action, I suppose, that being in tune with consciousness or whatever you want to call it, then spontaneously behavior flows in an appropriate way, or hopefully does.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a loving, you know, it's a loving thing. It comes from that deep, infinite, unconditional love for everyone involved. So, and you can't, it's not a predicted thing. It's not a, you know, understood by the mind thing.
Yeah. Obviously, we have a mind and we can use it, but the ramifications of every action are far more intricate than the mind could possibly comprehend. And so if the mind had to figure out all the ripple effects that would, you know, result from every action, it would be totally overwhelmed by the complexity. So what you're saying is simple, spontaneous, right action can flow from being grounded in a deep enough realization. And, you know, that divine intelligence, which can comprehend all the complexities of the universe, there's a saying in the Vedas, Brahman is the charioteer. So, you know, that is, if that's running the show, then, you know, our behavior can be as it would be if we had some sort of omniscience, which is beyond human capability anyway.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And then the human just catches up and goes, oh, that was interesting.
Yeah, wow. How did that come out of my mouth?
That's it. Kind of fun.
Yeah. So this next question, what we've just been discussing might be one of the answers to it, but you mentioned that coming home to our authentic selves leaves us open to a world of possibilities. Is this what we've just been discussing, the kind of possibility you're alluding to there?
Yeah, in each moment, like that freshness, that newness.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about shadow work and healing and compassion for a while. You emphasize the necessity of healing past trauma to reach our full potential, and this involves shadow work, turning towards the unconscious aspects we don't want to see and cultivating deep compassion for ourselves and others to break cycles of suffering. And of course, many people are now familiar with the term shadow work. I've interviewed people such as Connie Zweig, who wrote a whole book about it. How do you define it, and what is its role in healing?
I just define it as what's unconscious, what hasn't been brought to conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's
I think it was a Jungian term originally, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And the term itself, you know, it probably has a lot of baggage. You know, everything has energy, doesn't it? Everything has kind of like what the collective have put on it. So it probably has that sort of baggage of something a bit heavy and frightening when really it's not, you know, and it's wanting to, life's wanting to have those parts of ourselves rejoin, you know, that movement of rejoining. So yes, it can be anything from beliefs to stuck emotions, to patterns of behavior.
Uh-huh. You mentioned that for you, at least, it felt less like work and more like life was working on you, you know, rather than you were having to work to work something out. I get that right? I mean, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think it was both, because it was happening, you know, the unconscious, that, you know, Pandora's box had just been opened up. So it was flowing, you know, it was coming up. But at the same time, there had to be that human portion, that willingness to meet what was arising, and the willingness to really engage in deep healing.
So on a day-to-day basis, like, was just all kinds of like negative emotions or traumas that you had forgotten and things like that welling up? And did it make it difficult for you to function or hold down a job or things like that?
It was kind of like contraction, expansion, contraction, expansion. So it'd have these really big heart openings and unconditional love flowing. You know, I'd be looking at strangers and there would just be unconditional love, like, and all sorts of bliss and joy. And then there would just be a plunge back into suffering and contractions.
I think that's natural. I think that happens to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Quite wild, you know. So, and then other times where, just emptiness was looking. There wasn't any, unconditional love feeling or any of that. It was just pure witnessing.
Mm-hmm.
So that would kind of go, and then, you know, there would be the next contraction that would come. But I engage in deep somatic based healing, because my nervous system, because I'm extremely sensitive, which is one of my gifts, but my nervous system had gotten so dysregulated through traumas just kind of piling up on top of each other. So I really needed that, you know, for that phase when it's wanting to come in and embody and have all the fragmented, because trauma really fragments us. So all those fragmented parts, like, yeah, you too, you as well. And that's the compassion, you know, that compassion that wants all the parts of us that feel separate and lost and in pain and in confusion.
Were you doing some formal somatic healing work under some kind of trained person?
Yeah.
Or were you, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Like, so
yeah.
Therapeutic sessions in which you do something or other.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yeah. Through the body.
Was it mainly
accessing
talk
unconscious type
stuff, or was there like physical massage or acupuncture or, you know, those kind of things?
A little bit of acupuncture. Yeah. But more being with the body, creating, you know, the bridge of safety, because that's what's lost, isn't it? When we go through these things, it's that feeling of that we're safe. So being with it, creating that bridge, so, and getting the nervous system to come back down into some sort of
de-excitation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, that presence, then allowing bits to come up, but it can't all come up all at once.
Oh,
you
no.
know, it's too much for
yeah.
the nervous system. So just in little bits. So, and then, you know, you're kind of emptying the jar bit
mm-hmm.
by bit, and then more can come up and more can be released. And so body movements that the body wanted to do at the time.
Yeah. You mean like
but
Kriyas?
Got frozen. No, like through whatever happened at the time, you know, it wanted to push a boundary, or it needed to fight, or it needed to, you know, all the kind of primal survival instincts that are stuck. It's energy that's just gotten really stuck.
Yeah.
So,
cycle of expansion and contraction that you went through, did you get the feeling like the expansion phases were kind of like a solvent where, you know, once you're exposed to that vastness for a little while, all these tight things begin to loosen up and release. And then, of course, you go into contraction as they release. And then once they've sort of fizzled out in terms of that particular batch releasing, you open up to perhaps an even broader expansion, which triggers another release. Like, so you keep going through this cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. A batch.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's not, some stuff will get burnt up just through grace. You know, I had an experience of, because I had chronic illness as well, as a result of all the trauma and everything that had happened, I had an experience of the lady I was working with the somatic work, saying, "Oh, I think we need to slow down. You know, I think
she
that
thought it
your
might be
nervous
too much
system."
for you.
Yeah, because my nervous system is so sensitive, and so it's like, yeah, I think maybe we need to slow down. And I thought, oh shit, I'm like, slow down. Let's get this
let's
stuff
get it
out,
over
you know.
with.
Yeah, let's get it over with. And I was going through another sort of koan in my life where I was living at the time, you know, the land wasn't able to support my horses in a way that they would be as healthy as, you know, I would have liked them to have been. And so I was looking for somewhere else, and just couldn't, you know, bang up against it's not working, you know, I can't find anywhere. So those two sort of things were happening simultaneously. And then just out to lunch, one day and another just massive opening happened. And, you know, the food was blissful and just so beautiful, you know. You want to go in and kiss the chef, like the gratitude, you know. And that gave my nervous system enough of a relaxation for the healing, you know, and shifting whatever else was there to continue. So, you know, how much that burnt up or chewed up, we don't know. But
I bet you the horses have been very healing for you. How long have you been around horses? I mean, ever since a young age?
Well, the horse, no, I wasn't born into a family that was horse orientated at all. I literally was born in with that calling, I suppose. You know, when I was two, I asked for, it was the first toy that I asked for was
lifelike,
true to life form of a horse, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I just took that everywhere with me. Just absolutely loved it. And, you know, when I was really young, my favorite book was War Horse. And it didn't come
movie.
From. Yeah, right. Yeah, I haven't actually seen the movie. But yeah, so I don't know whether that was brought in from past lives, probably.
Yeah. I never worked with horses. In fact, I had a very early experience of falling off a horse at a state fair or something like that. I was doing the horse ride so many times, getting ride on a real horse, that the guys got kind of casual. They sort of threw me up on the saddle and I went right off the other side. But anyway, I did have an opportunity to work around cows for a while, you know, quite a few months of just shoveling cow manure and just building fences and taking care of the cows. And they just had such a vibe about them that, you know, you kind of entrain with their vibe. And I found it very profound and beautiful. It was really calming.
Yeah. Well, that's it, isn't it? It's like, it's common for, I think a lot of us that, when we start having openings or, you know, that call comes or whatever, we want to go and be more in nature.
Yeah.
You know, we like our wildness calls to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of it. But yeah, so with the horses, it wasn't really until I was older that I had sort of opportunity, you know, in my teenage years to start having stuff to do with them. And then I worked up north and on a cattle station and worked with horses there. So, and then just through my life, I'd sort of come in and out with it, sort of like through my 20s. And then when I found my mentor with horsemanship, that was like when I sort of fully sort of entered into, and I've been with them ever since.
Yeah.
But man, they can teach you some stuff. It's,
really.
There's, yeah, we really are the students.
Yeah, I can think of a number of examples. I've seen programs for prison inmates working with horses, and it's very therapeutic for them. I have a friend who has an autistic daughter, and her daughter goes to horse camp where horses work with the autistic kids, and it has a great effect.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's programs here in the U.S. where kids who are in the inner cities, you know, slum kind of areas, very high crime, high stress, they get to go out to the country and be with horses for a while. So I can probably think of a couple more examples, but it's a known healing modality.
Yeah. And I mean, I sort of, you know, I work with people obviously online with awakening and healing. But I also, have clients where I work with their horses for helping the horses with the horse's trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And the person with what's happening for them. And then finding that sort of, meeting point. So it's less about the horse necessarily being, the healing force, but it being a mirror for consciousness to.
Yeah, kind of a mutual, healing.
More of a mutual meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like with anything, I think there's some horses that would be at a soul level willing to participate in that, and then there's others that aren't. You know, so when I've ever used them in that capacity with clients, it's more as they just be themselves exactly as they are, and what is it that you're drawn to in them? And then that is like a mirror for the person's own wisdom to come forward for what they might need in that moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah. There's a guy in the U.S. named Cesar Millan who is called the Dog Whisperer. And his motto is, and people call him because they have problems with their dogs, but his motto is better human, better dog, because he usually has to fix the human, and then that solves the dog's problem.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's probably soul contracts going on, you know?
Yeah.
Where it's like, we're going to help highlight this for you, and really I'm just a translator to help sort of translate that, and they help us to slow down and to actually take notice. They remind me of my wildness, you know, that natural part. And I think that whole embodiment thing is like our wildness and the transcendent wisdom meeting and collapsing.
You state that anxiety is often a symptom of past trauma, which is not surprising, and that you mentioned that bringing compassionate awareness to these unresolved and incomplete fight or flight energies help to complete them. So how does one conjure up compassionate awareness, if that's a solution to healing certain kinds of trauma or anxiety? But what if you're not feeling compassionate awareness? How do you turn it up so as to, you know, help it, have it help heal these things?
Well, you can't, because that's us trying to manipulate it. It's there. It's available.
How do you locate it, I should say? It's already there, right? So how do you tune into it so as to...
Already there. Yeah. Well, you may need a bridge or a conduit or a, you know...
Such as?
Someone in support of you that can mirror that back to you. It could be any sort of practice that feels right for you. Even just using imagination as a bridge can be helpful. You know, it can start to relax the nervous system enough that maybe there's some safety here that I can open to, you know.
But give me an example of how that might work.
So if somebody's like really contracted and their nervous system's really dysregulated, they were to open fully to redemptive love completely, it might actually be too overwhelming. You know, and it sometimes has to be taken in bit by bit rather than all at once. So, you know, if we can create space for someone, even in their imagination, that is peaceful and they're held, you know, it's a relative thing, but it's got a thread back to the absolute that's safe.
So let's say you had a loving grandmother or something, but she's passed away. And so you might say, okay, imagine your grandmother is here with you now and she's holding you and she's singing you a lullaby or something. So you mean that kind of thing?
Yeah, you could do that. And that could be a bridge.
Okay.
That could be using the imagination as a bridge, for sure.
Good. Yeah. So grief, we've talked about anxiety, grief. That's an emotion that many people try to avoid. You connect it to love, saying that there is no grief without love. How does allowing ourselves to fully experience grief open the door to compassion? And I guess you, no grief without love. Does that mean, like, you know, if you didn't love your dog, you wouldn't be grieving if it died or something like that? If your heart is sort of cold and closed, then, and you're not experiencing much love, then you don't grieve for the people in Gaza or, you know, other situations, whereas a more sensitive person feels such others' pain very acutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's like the human element to it, you know, like our human heart. And then, of course, there's like the infinite heart that can just hold all that suffering. There's no limit to it. Mm. So, but you know, that's not to say that, if someone was to die and there was just infinite joy for their passing, that there's no love there, because there is, you know, that is unconditional love. So it's not like a hard and fast rule. I guess what I'm just pointing to is, not to contract or fear that grief, because it is an expression of love.
Yeah. And it's a natural thing. You know, we shouldn't stifle it.
No, and we've been so conditioned to.
Right.
You know, so conditioned to collectively. You know,
and even spiritual people sometimes intellectualize things away, like they're, somebody dies and you think, oh, they've just gone on to heaven or another loka or something like that. And, you know, if someone is grieving, they might say, oh, you shouldn't be grieving. There's even a verse in the Gita which says, you know, certain indeed is birth for the dead, and certain is death for the born. Therefore, over the inevitable, you should not grieve. But, you know, that can become it can be kind of an unnatural heartlessness or something if you try to force yourself to abide by such admonitions.
Yeah. And it's not in truth, you know, what's really there. What's really true.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, there's a human as well.
I suppose one way of wrapping up this point is just to be authentic. You know, I think that term came up 15 minutes ago. If you're feeling grief, feel grief. You know, don't try to rationalize it as being unspiritual and you shouldn't be feeling it or something.
Just that's it.
Be a human being. You're a human being. You're not just a divine being. You're also a human being.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I like to lean into the humanness, because it just, there's an allowance in that, you know, there's such an allowance for, let's all just be human.
Yeah. You noted that when faced with their own shadow, people can often react with unconscious and cruel behavior. And I found that point very timely. There's a lot of that in the world today. And I'm reminded of Jesus saying, "Forgive them, Father, they know not what they do." And, you know, I think there's here in the U.S. there's a lot of cruelty going on right now with, you know, people being captured and sent to third world, you know, third countries and put in basically hell holes of prisons in El Salvador and stuff like this. And they're not actually really guilty of anything. They're just being, shuffled away like that. And so I think as a nation, we in particular and many other nations need to cultivate the capacity for compassion and not succumb to unconscious and cruel behavior. Whole nations do succumb to that. Nazi Germany is an example. But obviously anything that a nation is doing, it's doing because enough people in that nation are doing it. And so there needs to be a kind of a national healing. But you can only start with yourself. You know, so
yeah, that's it.
We keep coming back to this theme, but how can one be less unconscious and thus more kind and compassionate and sensitive to the suffering of others.
Yeah, I think it's just a willingness to face that, face everything within us, you know, and that comes back to the what we were talking about before with the compassion, like compassion for what's here, unconscious within us. It naturally then flows out. We don't have to force it. It's just a natural movement.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You mentioned that you're a very sensitive person, and that's good. Is there a way that, I suppose you're just wired that way. You didn't do anything to sensitize yourself necessarily. But I think, spiritual practice can and does sensitize one. You know, you just become more refined, more delicate in a way, less crude, less blind to your own shadows, since we're using that term.
Well, it's dropping into the wisdom of the heart, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the key, I guess, is just dropping into the wisdom of the heart. And at the same time, you need to balance sensitivity with strength, do you not? Because if you became so sensitive that you couldn't go to the store or something, and I've known people who are like that. In fact, I've been like that on long meditation courses where you've been meditating for months on end. It's like, ooh, I can't possibly walk into town to buy a toothbrush. It's just like too much.
Nervous system so heightened. It's like picking up on everything.
So there's an integration factor that you have to somehow balance out with increased sensitivity. It's paradoxical.
Yeah.
But
it is.
Sensitivity and strength. The two.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And I think that before we were talking about with the wildness meets the wisdom, kind of we throw in there in the sensitivity as well, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think that grounding, like when you're talking about being with the cows and, being with nature and being with the horses, and that grounding really helps with that strength, that real like connection to the earth and being here. And
yeah, connection to the earth. That's a good one. I mean, I think that sometimes, well, I remember, when I first, I had interviewed Susanna Marie, and then we were a couple of years later, we were at this conference in California, and I was just totally wigged out by all the, the people and the energy. And I had like six interviews and a panel discussion and talk to give, and there was unlimited chocolate cake at lunch, and and I was like, it's kind of, and I remember she said, let's take a walk. And so we took a walk around through this little wooded area, and she said, let's take our shoes off and walk in the grass. So we walked in the grass, and then finally I just lay down in the grass and like, oh.
Oh, that's so funny. Your opinion on the cacao and the chocolate cake too.
But spiritual people are notorious for getting ungrounded, I've kind of gotten into a routine of plenty of exercise, plenty of sleep, nice grounding things in addition to meditating a couple hours a day.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's talk for a while about awakening itself. We've talked about anything more you want to say right now about shadow and healing trauma and that kind of thing?
I think so.
Okay. We can always come back to it if you think of something.
Yeah, sure.
Let's talk about the nature of awakening. Your teachings point to it. You've used the word nuance, and I've detected that in what I've heard you say, a nuanced understanding of awakening. I think this is important. It's not about escaping our humanity, very important, but finding the simplicity of truth within the complexity of life. And it involves devotion, finding safety in our divine nature, and learning to sync with, this last sentence I don't understand quite so well, maybe you can explain it, learning to sync with linear time to experience the timeless. So comment on everything I just said in that little statement.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thinking with lineal time, I'm really talking about nervous systems, because when our nervous systems are dysregulated, we're really stuck. We're stuck in the past or trying to rush towards some future point. And so syncing with it would be getting our nervous systems, and that's that whole embodiment thing, hey? Like getting our nervous systems to come into that point of balance, and then we can experience the timeless here.
So would it be a be here now kind of a thing, to quote Ram Dass,
Yeah.
the power of now, to quote Eckhart Tolle?
Yeah, because we can have these openings in transcendent, but when the movement comes back in for embodiment, if our nervous systems are out of time, and you'll see it. You'll go into like a cafe or something, and the person serving's like under massive stress, and their nervous system's like pinging. It's on fast forward. They're sort of, they're out of sync with time, or conversely, the opposite. When there's depression or collapse or just like shut down, and so the nervous system's like really stuck, and so either one is not lining up. It's not in sync with the moment, and so we take care of that, so that it can come and be here.
So in your own life, do you describe your own experience with regard to time? I could elaborate on that question, but see what you got from what I just said.
Well, certainly experience being out of sync with it. When the nervous system's like that, when it was going too fast, when it was going too slow,
You mean in the
and all
past
that
for
sort of
you?
stuff. Yeah,
Right.
yeah, yeah. And it's not to say that the nervous system isn't gonna spike, and it's not gonna have its fluctuations. It's not like it just goes into this like dead zone of like nothing happening. No one's there. There's still that the body that's but you can be with. Can be with that, you can be with the fluctuations rather than leaving, because that's what happens, when it's too overwhelming, we leave ourselves, we're frightening. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. My sense of, did you ever read a book by someone named, I think it was Suzanne Siegel, called Collision with the Infinite? Interesting book. She was this woman who had this spontaneous awakening, and it was quite radical, and she couldn't really find any sense of personal self after that, and it terrified her. And she went through like 10 years of trying to find a personal self before she finally gave up and realized something good had happened. But her motto became, do the next obvious thing. And that, to a great extent, is my motto. Not that I think about it all the time, but kind of nature presents the next obvious thing to you, and then you do it without a lot of, we've talked about this earlier, without a lot of complexity, without a lot of intellectualization. It's like you can almost trust that you're going to be presented with what is supposed to be next, and then you can do, then you just do that. So that's what came to mind when I started thinking about this topic of time.
Absolutely. And the horses are great for that, because when you get out of alignment with that, they're gonna let you know
They
if
pick
you're
up on it,
listening deep
right?
enough. Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, talking before about the other part of my work that I do, I'm always trying to put myself as much as I can in the hooves or the shoes of the horse. And I their awareness you know, and that varies depending on the horse and their kind of makeup and all that sort of stuff. But it's just because we spend so much time in our thoughts or our minds, our awareness compared to theirs, you know, they're helping lead us home with that. You know, and I've had clients that, when I first met them, there's so many fragmented parts of themselves, that they haven't seen me and I've seen them and they've gotten quite close and I think, oh, they still haven't seen me. And then I know how the horses feel. You know, when we're going to interact with a horse and we're fragmented or we're not there, we're not home, we're not in the moment. They're like, oh, that person's not home.
Yeah, they don't like it.
They know. They really do. So, yeah,
So
I've
you find
forgotten where we
that
started with that.
that horses
I got
can,
lost in it.
and do you find that you can either you yourself or people that you work with horses, you can help them to entrain their consciousness to the consciousness of the horse and thereby become more simple, which is not to say we become like a horse in terms of our perception or our consciousness, but that's what I was saying about the cows. There was something so simple and grounded about the cows that just hanging out with them all day, I just entrained with their consciousness and just got into this like really subtle, settled state. Even though I was, working hard, shoveling manure and building fences and stuff, I think probably a lot of people can relate to this. That's why we love animals so much. They're not just cute and cuddly, but they actually have a good effect on our mentality, our consciousness.
Come to resonance.
Yeah, that's it. That's the word. Good one.
In resonance with unity, you know. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure there's some interesting stories here that one could tell. I don't know them, but about native peoples, Aborigines in Australia or Native Americans or whatever, and their affinity, almost like a psychic affinity with animals. Oh, as a matter of fact, I heard a story about this where this, it was some sort of indigenous hunter or something like that, and he had not only had to worry about the scent he might be leaving, depending on where he was and which way the wind was going and stuff. But he had to worry about, not worry, but he had to be mindful of his moods and thoughts and so on, because animals could pick up on it.
Absolutely. I love that. I love that. That connection back to our wildness and, like you say, you know, Indigenous people, that connection and, to all our gifts, you know, because, as you know, the gift that can open with awakening, they're there in everyone, maybe in different ways. You know, some people are more leaning towards certain gifts and others towards others, but they weren't disconnected, you know, the Indigenous people from that connection with earth and our wildness. You know, the transcendent is in, it's right in the middle of the wildness, right in the middle of that.
And there's a point, that could be added here, which is that it's not that horses are enlightened or babies are enlightened or indigenous people are enlightened because they're simple. That's a quite, and you feel free to disagree with this, but I think there's something Ken Wilber talks about called the pre-trans fallacy, where people, say, oh, horses, babies, and so on, they're enlightened. We have to get back to that state. Well, we don't want to get back to the infancy. We want it because we're adults. But you can kind of come full circle and achieve human maturity and your wisdom and your personality and all those things. And yet, as Jesus said, be gentle as doves, wise as serpents, gentle as doves. So you can kind of regain the innocence and simplicity of those examples, but you're not going to you know, be simplistic. You're not going to be infantile. You could be very mature and wise, and yet as Jesus also said, you know, except ye be as little children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And you know, when you talk about enlightenment, and you know, babies or horses or anything else being enlightened, you know, that whole evolutionary arc, I just don't think that. I think we like to have it wrapped up in kind of a box of that. Well, they're there and that's there, and like I like to just leave it to. Well, it's the mystery, isn't it? Just unfolding in different forms. And
so that's good. I mean, I do think there is such a thing as levels of evolution and a whole kind of, you know, spectrum or scale of evolution. I mean, a mosquito is not the same as a monkey, or, you know, that kind of thing. But you can't really make hard and fast decisions about it. You know, it's just more of a broad understanding.
It leaves us kind of more open. You can feel it.
Yeah. And certainly, regardless of the level of evolution of anything, it's all the divine, you know.
That's it.
A rock, for that matter.
I've met some beautiful rocks here on the land.
Yeah. Okay, so here's a question. We could call this finding safety in the infinite. You say that with trauma, the body loses its sense of safety. And you speak of a deeper absolute trust that is synonymous with surrender. The ancient traditions speak of our divine nature as never having been hurt or damaged, sort of being beyond the possibility of harm. Let's come back to like practicalities. How can people sort of establish their connection or their establish that as their foundation, and thereby be in a state of safety, regardless of the challenges that life throws at them?
Well, I think that comes back to what we were talking before about grounding.
Mm.
You know, that's hugely important for the body. And, you know, you talking about your conference that you were at, it's only in a mild way. I know you weren't, you know, flipping your lid or anything, but yeah.
But I'm just you were kind of
having that moment.
Hyper-stimulated with all the people and the food and the parks and the...
Yeah, exactly. And you had that direct experience of, you know, when you grounded yourself, then that the body can like, oh, okay, oh, I'm safe. And so Mother Earth was the conduit to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was the bridge for your body, because it's all the one body.
Yeah. And of course, the word ground is sometimes associated with being itself, the ground of being, you know, pure consciousness or whatever, being the sort of ultimate foundation of everything.
And it doesn't mean that fear still, fear might not arise when that's coming. You know, the first time I had that fear really come up, it was very much a psychological fear of the void, or, you know, like, and it was like, oh, I'd felt fear before, obviously. But that fear was like, I'm going to be completely taken out, like just non-existence. And the fear like really arose, but it was of a psychological constructed self that was going to never exist again.
Was this on the verge of some spiritual shift that you went through?
Yeah, just another opening. And,
That happens to a lot of people. There's sort of a threshold you cross where there's a big upsurge of fear, after which it's kind of like breaking the sound barrier. It's smooth after you break it, but until as you approach it, it gets really rough.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and certainly for me, it wasn't just a one-time thing. It wasn't just a one-time break the sound barrier and all is good. It revisited, you know, like the waves come, like we were talking about before, you know, washing.
Expansion,
washing
contraction.
Away.
Yeah.
The batches. Yeah,
right.
That's it. And so the second time that fear really came up, it was experienced very differently. And it was just experienced as the survival instinct in the body. And there wasn't that sort of psychological component of it. And my mind was like, oh, like the fear of death is here and it's just in the body. It's just survival mechanism in the body. And then the next day in meditation, I went into, I suppose, what spiritual people call samadhi, where everything just collapsed.
So that fear was like a precursor to the samadhi that happened the next day.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a saying in the Upanishads which goes, certainly all fear is born of duality. And it almost seems like, again, there's this sort of guardian at the gate of unity that is a fear membrane that you have to, you know, get through as duality merges into unity. A phrase you use, in fact, you gave us this phrase to put on your little YouTube thumbnail, is healing the intimate divide. Is that what we're talking about right now? Or if not, what is this intimate divide that you're referring to in that phrase? And what does the process of healing it entail?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely what we were just talking about.
Okay, good. Good timing. Yeah,
perfect. Perfect timing. Divine timing.
Doing the next obvious thing. Okay, two questions, Damon. Let's answer them, or ask them. Okay. This one is from Michael Mitas in London. Michael, you're up late. Is it possible to manifest our desired reality? And if so, how?
Interesting. Well, the question denotes that it's a me doing it, that it's a separate someone. So I'll answer it in a slightly different way. I think there is something that we can offer ourselves to something larger than just our humanness, offer ourselves to healing, and in that way we can align with what wants to really unfold. And what wants to really unfold might be better than what we ever could think that we want, you know. We sort of get these ideas of we want to manifest certain things, we want to create certain things in our life, and they're not necessarily going to make us happy, maybe temporarily, you know, but it depends on what you're sort of interested in.
Yeah. Sort of a let thy will be done thing.
And it's understandable, you know, that drive, because everybody wants to live a fulfilled life. You know, everybody wants to be healthy, and that's just a common human thing. But if we can trust that life knows better than us kind of what's good for us, then we can go, okay, well, let's, as a devotional thing, let's offer ourselves to this path and see where it leads.
You know, there's these popular things like The Secret, and there's this lady named Esther Hicks or something who channels some entity called Abraham, and it's all about manifestation. So manifestation's been a big popular thing in New Age circles. Like you just said,
and there's nothing wrong with it.
No, and it's natural to have desires. We have desires, but
absolutely.
Yeah, I had a teacher who one of his favorite phrases was "highest first." There's so many things you could want. Want the highest, and then let let everything else kind of fall into line after that.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, it's really good. And I was going to say one other thing about that. It's gone now. It might come back.
Okay. You just go ahead and say it if it does. Here is a question from Prachi Dixit in Torrance, California. What would you suggest to help us uplift the collective consciousness? By uplifting collective, I mean lift humanity to its true nature.
Yeah, I think that comes back to what we were saying before, that we can only be responsible for what's here in our shadow. So what's here in our unconscious is it's not just for ourselves. That is an offering to all of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Our state of being is going to have a profound effect on not only the people and the animals close to us in our lives, but, you know, that ripples out. So, and that kind of almost goes back to the manifesting question with the trusting of what wants to unfold, you know, that you will be given what you need to live out this life, to offer.
Yeah. Yeah, the ripple effect that you mentioned is very important, I think, because all of us all the time are emanating some kind of influence. And if we look at the whole world and the state of it, then, okay, what are we looking at? We're looking at the collective, you know, total, sum total of all the influences that are being radiated by 8 billion people. And obviously, it's somewhat lacking. So what can we do to help the world radiate a better influence?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we don't know what it's going to look like necessarily at the start, you know, like we don't know in what way life is going to want to use us to serve. We have no idea. And it's just trusting that it's going to find its way.
I think it helps to just have the desire to be used by life or the divine. St. Francis, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. You know, if you have that, you know, where there is this, let me sow that, and so on. I think if you have that sort of desire to be an instrument of the divine, then you're more likely to be one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, it can be in like the smallest thing. It doesn't need to be some big thing. It can be like just moment to moment. Are we radiating that kindness? That are we allowing that compassion to flow through us? Wariness, are we unconscious where it, you know, it gets blocked, that flow?
No, small things are important. If we don't do the small things, we're probably not going to do the big things.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to seem like some kind of like I'm tooting my horn, but I can't walk down a sidewalk where I see a worm stranded on the sidewalk without bending over and picking the worm up and throwing it on the grass. You know, it's going to die in the sun if it lies on the sidewalk. So,
yeah, it's beautiful. It's like a devotion. Devotion's coming through.
I thought, oh, the poor little thing, it's stranded. I got to pick it up. okay, devotion, good timing. My next point was about devotion and simplicity. And devotion is a recurring theme in your work. You speak of a true devotion of life itself that never abandons us. Okay, what do you think is the relationship between this devotion that you refer to and simplicity that you say is at the heart of any authentic realization?
Oh, you just highlighted it beautifully in your story about the worms.
Okay, yeah.
You did it for me, Rick.
Okay, good.
We've got an invasive weed that grows here. It's a South African weed called Cape weed. And it really, you know, with cleared ground, it really takes over. And it's not good. Anyone who's out there listening who's horsey knows that it's not good for horses.
Right. And it's probably invading their grassy fields and things.
Yeah. Well, actually, some of the native Australian grasses are really good for horses. It's kind of interesting, like that whole, you know, what's actually good for what would actually be good for the earth to be regenerated back to the native grasses would be good for the animals, would be, you know, that whole But yeah, the cape weed, it's really quite bad here, and it's the job to pull it all out by hand is it's far more enormous than my body's capable of.
Right.
But I do it anyway.
Oh, okay.
You know, and as I'm doing it, it's this simple act of devotion. Just me and the horses and the paddock and the weeds.
Did you ever hear the story of the old man and the starfish? Yeah, made a difference to that one, he says, as he picks a starfish up, and there's thousands of them on the beach, and the kid says, what difference does it make if you throw one in the water? Well, it made a difference to that one. You guide meditations. I've heard some of your meditations on YouTube to evoke the still mind of the divine. This is a good one. The second verse of the Yoga Sutras say, yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind. Of course, it's in Sanskrit, but that's what it means. So, how in your opinion does quieting the mind, help us access the timeless, peaceful state, the ground state?
Well, it's more about where our attention goes than trying to quiet the mind. So if our attention is constantly caught by thought, then that's what we'll get more of, just trapped in thought. But if our attention can rest in that gap,
beyond thought,
in the stillness, we get more of that. So that's sort of the tool that we have, is where is our attention.
Do you find that, like, when you're busy doing something, could be a simple thing like washing the dishes, or a little bit more complicated like driving a car, or even, you know, like right now having a conversation. Do you find that there's a dimension that is always in stillness, which maybe there wasn't when you were, you know, 15 years old or something, but it's become a kind of a natural feature of your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly there when I was 15, but, you know, I had no idea.
It was kind of overshadowed by stuff probably then.
Too fragmented.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's there for everybody, but most people are overshadowed.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's kind of the music's too loud. Someone's turned the stereo up too loud.
Yeah. You took a fair amount about embodiment and also mysticism. So you seem to, speak of a blend of mystical and groundedness. And you reference the archetypes of the Divine Mother and the Warrior. And you work with subtle energies and benevolent helpers, all while remaining deeply rooted in the physical. So these benevolent helpers, I presume you're talking about guardian angels or something of that nature, some subtle beings that aren't obvious to the human perception, but are nonetheless among us and helping us.
Yeah, wish I'd known about them sooner.
Well, they knew about you.
They knew about me. They know about all of us. Yeah, I don't really label them as sort of guardian angels or guardian anything necessarily. Just that they're there. They're there, and they're support for us. You know,
how do you know they're there? Somebody might ask, how do you know they're there?
As your path goes, and as the more subtle senses open up, knowing things in that subtle realm, it's like, I know that you're here talking to me. It's like that. It's really hard to explain that knowing. It just is. And when it comes through with really profound things that you need right in that moment, and it moves you, and it moves that emotion, like, you know, it's authentic.
Yeah.
That's probably the best way to explain it. But it happens a lot for me through, just like a clairaudience, sometimes a claircognizance, just a knowing, like hearing a voice that you know is not yours.
Yeah, like intuition.
Different to my intuition. And that's how I know. Like, I know when it's like intuition that's arising in me, or when it's another subtle being that's helping God.
Huh. That's good. I bet you a lot of people listening can relate to that.
That first question, the manifesting question, that was the point that I was going to say, that if he's offering himself to his spiritual path and his healing or whatever's happening for him, tuning into that internal navigation, the clearer we get, the easier that is. And that's going to help him in the fulfillment of, you know, a good life.
Yeah, so it might seem a little esoteric to some people to think that there are these sort of subtle beings of some kind that are hanging around and helping us out, but it really can become obvious, kind of second nature, that, and almost something you can rely on, you know.
Unless they decide that you need to do it on your own.
Yeah, or unless you're pushing in the wrong direction, then they might, you know, block it, you know, or I don't know if it's them or what, but you might meet resistance, and then maybe if you're wise, you think, okay, there must be a reason for this resistance. Am I supposed to push on through it, or am I getting a sign that this is not the direction I should go on? I should go over this way instead.
Yeah, and it's a whole journey that, you know, like learning to navigate the realizations and the different stages. But yeah, they've certainly helped me if I've been maybe going on or go down that way. They're like, no, maybe don't go that way, you know, and it is very different to my own arising of knowing that.
Yeah.
And then when we don't listen, we all get that, and then we don't listen. Even the not listening is intelligent, because there's a lesson there that needs to be played out for whatever reason.
Yeah. I don't perceive these things visually, but I had a friend who did. And, you know, he would say that, you know, he could be in a group of, you know, people like that conference I referred to, and he would see these beings of some kind around people. And he didn't know exactly what they were doing, but everyone seemed to have their little attendants, you know, and this is a whole bunch of spiritual people, you know, who are spiritual teachers and stuff who are in this conference. And, you know, there are a lot of teachers and traditions who say that, you know, there are probably more beings in the subtle realm than there are in the gross. I interviewed this guy named David Spangler, who was one of the founders of the Findhorn community in Scotland. And, you know, he had been seeing and communicating with these things all his life. I think it's interesting. I mean, you know, we'd be like, it'd be big news if a UFO landed on the White House lawn. But, you know, think of the fact that there could be more beings in this world of a subtle nature than there are gross beings such as we. And that's even bigger news in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of, it keeps us humble too, I think. It keeps us humble that we don't get too wrapped up in our own stuff, to know that there's these beings in other realms, and perhaps we can't have the full picture here.
I wonder if there'll come a time when humanity is so evolved that, you know, it will be common for people's awareness to, you know, encompass a broader range of creation, and it'll be kind of ordinary for us to perceive these subtler beings that, as opposed to just being some extraordinary thing that very few people have.
Yeah. Well, that's it. And it does. It just becomes normal. Things that before, when you're sort of contracted and cut off, that would have just seemed like mind blowing. It's just, well, of course, it's just normal. It becomes normalized. It doesn't seem odd at all.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Very beautiful. But yeah.
A friend sent me a whole long, like 20-minute message the other day, and I hadn't talked to him for about a year. But I had been just thinking about him for a couple of days. And so when his message came, and I called him up on WhatsApp, and I said, well, I'm not surprised that you sent me that message. I've been thinking about you for a couple of days.
Yeah. And that's really common.
Yeah. You shared a beautiful experience of the Divine Mother gazing through you Can you speak about that a little bit more, and about the feminine aspect of the divine and what it means to be an embodied mystic?
I think what you're referring to was with my little doggy. When I was very lovingly gazing upon him, you know, there's that personal relationship. Obviously, you know, there's no one else that is his mother. I'm his mother, apart from his actual dog mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gazing upon him with all this love in that personal relationship, my motherly love. And then that personal just gets pushed aside, and then it's like literally divine mother gazing upon him. Unconditional love. And just a strange, so much love and intimacy, but like a strange detachment. There's not that personal, that personal relationship is not there. There's something else.
It reminds me of a Maharishi Mahesh Yogi wrote this poem called Love and God. And there was a section in the poem where he said, personal love is concentrated universal love. And they said, I said, my heart flows when I say personal love is concentrated universal love. But I guess we could think of, you know, the divine mother or universal love as being a field of which we are just little conduits. And, you know, and ordinarily we feel love, and it seems like it's kind of coming from us, but probably it's coming through us to whatever extent it can. It sounds like in that case, you know, you had the realization that, you know, it was a much broader field that you were just the kind of a magnifying glass for.
That's it. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
That again is, I mean, I keep going to the global implications of this stuff, but, you know, again, imagine if everybody in the world could be conscious conduits of universal love. It would be such a different world.
And it's inevitable, I think. It's inevitable. It's just, are we going to commit to, you know, our devotion, bringing our human devotion to our paths? Mm-hmm. Are we going to do that now, or are we going to wait? And how much suffering is going to happen between those two points?
Yeah. I mean, there's no practical reason why everybody in the world couldn't be properly fed and housed and cared for with health care and everything else. It's just human, you know, limitations screwing it all up. These points, I mean, they seem obvious to us, I think, but I don't seem to be obvious to everybody in the world, because, you know, people keep seeming to think that some particular, you know, political or economic or solution is going to come along to solve all our problems.
Yeah.
Aldous Huxley said that there are no, all these problems that beset us in the world are not problems. They're symptoms. They're symptoms, of, you know, the kind of, the lack of the kind of realization that you and I are talking about.
Yeah. Symptoms of the core wound, hey? Separation.
Right. On a mass scale.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking a minute ago about the divine feminine peering through your eyes at your dog. There's also kind of the warrior archetype. I don't know if you talk about that, but how do you balance these two energies? The sort of, and actually when you think of mothers and their motherly love, they often balance that with the warrior archetype, you know, having to, rescue a child from a vicious dog or whatever, you know. Speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, that's it. And that's that whole not rejecting our, I mean, I'm calling it wildness just because I like that word. Rejecting our wildness, rejecting that innate intelligence that would do that, that would protect the child. You know, that would stand up for oneself, or would stand up for others. from that place that's not divided, you know, from life itself. So, and I think that, there's probably still something in us that wants to separate that out, like that they can't coexist in harmony, that the all-loving, unconditional, divine mother that seems warm and welcoming, that it can coexist with the warrior archetype, and that's actually really necessary.
Are you saying it can, but it often doesn't?
Yeah, it often doesn't. And there's often, I think, a collective kind of pushing away of that, you know, like, well, I can't be that because I have to be this, you know, like that whole idea of it, rather than it just being what it is, the truth of it. And the truth of it is that it does coexist.
Yeah. Sometimes I think of spiritual evolution as a greater and greater capacity to contain opposites and paradoxes.
Yeah.
Not having
absolutely
to be black and white, on and off, this or that, but being able to sort of hold the multidimensional paradoxical nature of the universe within your awareness.
Yeah. And to be whatever the moment is asking.
Yeah, whatever
for.
It calls for.
Whatever it calls for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it could come through as like a fierceness in
it
that
could.
Warrior. I mean, Joan of Arc is a striking example of that.
Yeah, it's just a little teenage girl.
Yeah, you can't fathom it, can you? I mean, and
yeah.
The unconsciousness of what they did to her.
Right. If you read her biography or her, yeah, her biography, there was a profound mystical dimension to her that somehow impelled her to take on the role that she did.
Yeah. She certainly had surrender.
Yeah.
Sewn up, that's for sure.
Yeah, what they did to her, you know, that reminds me of something I discussed in my interview last week with Adamar Curran, who's this Irish mystical woman. But we were talking about all the horrible, not that we want to dwell on this, but all the horrible things that have been done to mystics and even like herbalists or whatever during the Dark Ages, during the Middle Ages, you know, people being burnt at the stake for knowing about herbs or something like that. Or having mystical experiences, you know, just it's probably in a way it's sign of for optimism, because these days such things are coming to the fore and people aren't being, you know, killed for them. They're being respected and it's being recognized more and more widely. So that might give us hope for the world.
Yeah. It's becoming more common, but I think that it's still in the collective, that fear of the mystical, and really it's just fear of death, isn't it? When you get right down to it, that their fear of death, the fear of the unknown, the fear of what they can't control.
Yeah. I mean, just speaking of religious traditions, usually what happens after some great, you know, seer comes and establishes a whole new wave of knowledge is, you know, after a generation or two, the administrators move in and take over the whole thing. And then, they don't understand the mystics and they feel threatened by them. And so the mystics end up getting persecuted and the whole thing becomes a complete polar opposite of what its founder intended.
And then you've got mystics intergenerational trauma.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. I mean, there's people that knew me prior to awakening and they might not come out and say it to me, but they probably think I've totally lost my mind, you know, like, because it's so far from their paradigm of life.
Yeah.
That they can't fathom it. They can't fathom it, you know, and it's, they don't realize that that's actually, rather than an in insanity, it's actually coming into sanity, whole awakening process.
And, you know, again, it's a matter of what is the norm. And someone like you is an outlier. You're not the norm, thank God. But, you know, there could and hopefully will become a society in which, you know, mystics are the norm, which is not to say they'll all be sitting around, you know, contemplating their belly buttons. The practical stuff can get done. But from the kind of the normal higher state of consciousness that everyone will be living. And then, you know, someone who's not living that will be the aberration or the oddball. It's like, you know, even think about how the world has changed since, let's say, the 1800s, and, you know, everything we took for granted in the 1800s, and a train was about as fast as anything could ever travel, and, you know, things like that. And there was no conception that there was other galaxies out there, or even that we were in a galaxy. People didn't know what we were in. And now look at all the things we take for granted. I mean, look at our cell phone is a much more powerful computer than the computer that was used to get the astronauts to the moon. And we carry it around in our pockets. It can do all this stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the pace of change is accelerating. And AI, I don't think people realize what an earth-shaking development AI is, and how it's going to really shake things up in the next couple of years. It already is. Amazon has more robots working for it now than it does people. But anyway, as Dylan said, the times they are changing, and it's exciting to be in the midst of it. But I think it's not just technological change. I think it's spiritual change, and there's a real renaissance going on in that regard.
Yeah. Well, I saw you interviewed. I can't remember his surname, Father Sean, someone Irish.
Diarmuid O'Murchu, the Irish mystic, about a month ago. Oh, Sean O'Leary. Sean O'Leary, right.
He was
a cool guy.
And he was saying about his experience with a mystical being, saying that there was going to be three kind of segments of the evolutionary arc of humanity.
I forgot that what he said, because it was a few years ago. But go ahead and remind us.
Yeah, something about homeopsychopathius or something. And then there was homo spiritualis, and then homo artificialis. So like a cyborg.
There could be. I saw this little video the other day of this robot that's wandering around Austin, Texas, and it goes up to people and introduces itself and say, "Hey, nice Apple Watch you have, and hey, cool T-shirt, you know." And he can pick out all kinds of details about the person. And the reason there's a buzz about it is that nobody knows who owns this robot or where it came from or why it's wandering the streets of Austin.
He's saying, "I'm not anybody. He's sovereign.
Yeah.
No one's slave." But when you were talking about 1800s, it drew my attention to horses, you know, because obviously in the past, like, horses would have been so pivotal in our society, and I think now, like, with the raising of consciousness and the evolutionary arc that we're on, it's like a time of giving back to them, you know, like, because all the modern comforts that we enjoy were literally grown off the back of horses, as in a lot of instances, as kind of like slaves, really.
Yeah.
You know, because if it wasn't for horses, we'd probably still be, I don't know, hunter gatherers or something. They really advanced humanity, and sometimes people can kind of have a negative idea or association. Not everyone has a positive idea or association with horses. Like, more like, oh, well, you know, a really cold-hearted kind of, why would you bother? It's a lot of work, or it's a lot of, you know, whatever. And I'm like, a gratitude to them is due. Like, even if you've never had anything to do with them.
Yeah, that's nice. And our gratitude to all the animal species. I mean, we've really given them a raw deal. You know, I forget who it was. It might have been Einstein, or maybe it was Gandhi. Said some quote about how, you know, you can kind of measure the level of evolution of humanity by the way it treats animals, something like that. And we're not doing so well by that measure yet.
Not yet.
You know,
Yeah.
there's just,
It's definitely.
I mean, I live in a town where, I mean, in a state where there are 3 million people and 23 million pigs. And there's a big controversy going on right now because California, which is more progressive than Iowa, insists that pigs be given at least 24 square feet of space to live in all their lives, which is what? 4 by 6. That's not a whole lot of space. And but the Iowa pig farmers are saying, oh, that's, you're infringing upon our business model. You know, that's not practical to give them that much space. And that they want them to be in little confinements where they can't even turn around. Because
Oh,
it's, they
horrendous.
somehow make more money. And pigs are more intelligent than dogs by most measures.
Yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah. So this kind of thing, I mean, there's got to be some karmic consequences to the way we treat animals.
Yeah, that cut off. It's just, yeah. And that's that whole thing goes back to the second question of like, how do we help? We help by attending to what's here, because I think that the level of compassion that, is allowed to flow for all the parts of ourselves that are in pain or unconscious or wounded is directly proportional to what then flows out for others. And you can see it even with people that are very loving and kind, but they haven't gone to that depth. And there'll be that moment of like, oh, that hurts, because they're not able to include that suffering of whether it's an animal or a person or whatever being in, but it's because there's parts of themselves that are suffering that haven't been included.
So you're saying that if they could somehow reconcile or heal their own suffering, their own shadows, then compassion would be a spontaneous outcome or flow from that. Yeah, inevitably, I think.
It's inevitable. Yeah,
yeah.
It is. It's interesting. I out of all kind of like the sages or mystics, whatever, Ramana Maharshi was one that I didn't know anything about him, but you know, I'd heard his name and I was like drawn to him, felt drawn to him over others, you know. And then I found out later that apparently he was a real animal lover and
oh,
really
yeah. Crows. He had a cow named Lakshmi, whom he considered to be enlightened. And he would often, while he was giving darshan, he would often just be staring at the squirrels climbing up and down the trees and things like that.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're talking about all our capacities, how we have that capacity to know. So there was knowing in me that there was a resonance with him, with that whole connection with animals and that love for them.
Yeah, a lot of sages have been like that. St. Francis is famous as all these paintings of him with birds landing on him and things like that. And there was a story about Yogananda that this deer had come to live in the ashram and somebody fed it too much milk and it was dying because it had overdrunk milk. And Yogananda was holding it in his lap and just, you know, loving it and praying for it to live. And then the soul of the deer said to him, "Let me go. It's time for me to go. You're holding me back," you know. But anyway, it's quite typical, I think, of saints and sages having an affinity with animals. It's almost like an indicator of their level of development.
Yeah. That inclusion of all beings.
Which in a way is like symptomatic of godliness, you could say, because God certainly loves all creatures. And if we are really kind of in God consciousness, if we want to call it that, then we're going to exhibit the same qualities as God.
And then you've got to balance that with practicality, you know, like I'll go out in the forest to cut firewood with one of my friends who's very mystical. And, you know, you get too lost in looking at the amazing like mushrooms that have grown out, and you're just like, oh, I don't want to cut this bit of wood because there's just so
yeah, it's
much
the home to
beauty.
these mushrooms.
Yeah. That's practicality, is that you got to stay warm as well. So,
yeah. But it's like not taking more than you need. I think that's an important principle. And that's again, something like, you know, the Native Americans, they would kill bison, you know, buffalo, but only what they needed. And then they would use every bit of it. And then when the white men built the railroad through the West, you know, they would just stop the train and people would shoot all the bison and leave them to rot on the prairie. And in part because they wanted to starve out the Native Americans. But, you know, completely idiotic way to behave that is indicative of the mentality of those people, you know.
Cut off from themselves, or they don't realize that what they're doing to themselves.
Yeah, exactly. I keep quoting Jesus, but he said, whatsoever you do unto the least of these, you do unto me. And I think everyone could say that. Well, aren't we full of wisdom? All this pontification. Anyway, it's a fun conversation.
Good fun.
Yeah. So, and I apologize to people if you feel I've talked too much. Sometimes I talk too much, and Irene is not in the room to hand me notes telling me not to. So in any case then, so to wrap it up, you know, looking at the full tapestry of your journey so far, and your journey is far from over, you know, the trauma, the awakening, the shadow work, the devotion. What's been the ultimate realization for you so far? If that's a fair question, you can always tell me that's not a good question.
That life is living itself.
Nice. And where do we fit into that equation?
Go along for the ride.
Yeah.
Hopefully have some fun.
So you interact with people. You do one-on-ones, I presume. You have maybe some kind of group meetings, different things like that, right? And actually, you mentioned you often get intuitive insights for clients before you have sessions with them. And and then, like, when you have the session, you realize, oh, this insight is absolutely pertinent to what this person just brought up, right?
Yeah. Sometimes it's an insight specifically for them. Other times I'm just drawn to talk about something totally random, and it's exactly
what they needed to hear, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Or I might even share something about my own life for some reason. I think, why am I doing this? And then it's for them.
Good. So people listening to this, I'll put a link to your website. And I presume that on your website, you have ways of getting in touch with you and page about events or services and all that stuff, right?
Yeah. There's an events page that they can go on and they'll see, I think, the next date, the 10th of August, and just email.
What are you going to do on the 10th of August?
I'm going to do one that I've done before that the group really liked. I called it the Healing Chamber.
How do you work out the time zones?
Well, 10 a.m. my time, so it's not far off that now, so.
Yeah, so okay, so that would be like 9 in the evening in the central U.S. or whatever.
Yeah.
And you have an email sign-up thing there on your site, so if people want to be notified of things, they can sign up.
Yeah, they'll get notified of the groups and various things. And if anybody's in WA, or if they're in Australia or they're traveling here, that I'm running a retreat for 2 days in September.
In Western Australia?
That's on my website. Yeah, right on the beachfront. So
ooh, that sounds nice.
Really beautiful. Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Great. All righty. Well, keep up the good work. And it's been lovely talking to you and meeting you.
Yeah, really nice to meet you.
Yeah, I really appreciate everything you're doing and everything that most of the people I talk to are doing. I sort of felt like, in a way, if I can help them, then I can help the world through them, you know, by just bringing them to more people's awareness.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so thank you.
It's been fun.
Yeah, it has been. Thanks to those who've been listening or watching. We'll have another one in a couple of weeks with a guy named Dan Kelso. And I won't talk much about him right now. We'll just see what he has to say when we have our interview. So thanks, Savita.
Thank you.